This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The city of St. Louis in Missouri is the latest flashpoint in the national debate over police brutality and a lack of accountability in the criminal justice system. Last Friday, September 15th, Jason Stockley, the white police officer facing first-degree murder charges in the 2011 killing of a black man named Anthony Lamar Smith, was acquitted. The acquittal prompted days of protests by St. Louis residents and activists under the banner of Black Lives Matter. Missouri Governor Eric Greitens called in the National Guard, and police decked out in riot gear arrested hundreds of people. Reports have emerged that police were heard chanting, "Whose streets, our streets," a refrain popularized by social justice activists for many years. Acting Police Chief Lawrence O'Toole said earlier this week, "We're in control. This is our city and we're going to protect it." St. Louis neighbors Ferguson, the site of mass protests against the police shooting of Mike Brown, which brought the Black Lives Matter movement to prominence just about 3 years ago. My guest is Jody Armour. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California, the author of Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, The Hidden Costs of Being Black in America. He's also a Soros Justice Senior Fellow of the Open Society Institute's Center on Crime, Communities, and Culture. And he's the Race and Criminal Justice Correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Jody.
Good to be back with you, Sonali.
First, the issue of Anthony Lamar Smith's killing and the fact that it took so long for this trial to end is part of the question, right? The killing took place in 2011. So we're talking about something that happened 6 years ago. And there was much evidence that pointed to the fact that the white officer in question planted a gun in Anthony Lamar Smith's car. This case was clearly problematic, and yet Mr. Stockley was acquitted. Can you share your thoughts on the actual case itself?
Yeah, well, justice delayed is justice denied. Mm-hmm. To take this long to get at the heart of this case is unconscionable. But the result in this case is not a surprise, Sonali. By this point, certainly we've seen a string of acquittals and cases that seemed open and shut. Even take a case like Walter Davis, when he was shot 5 times in the back, running away from the police officer on a video. When the jury looked at that case, one said, "No way I'm convicting him." And 5, when the judge declared a deadlock, said, "Well, we were still really torn and uncertain about whether or not he had applied excessive force under the circumstances." So, Rodney King, we all saw the video, and there was an acquittal there in Simi Valley. There was acquittal in the Trayvon Martin case. There's acquittal after acquittal that tells us that this isn't just an isolated case, of course, but this is part of a larger pattern. And that pattern is, when it comes to blue lives and versus black lives, black lives don't matter in the judgments of the fact finders and decision makers in the courtroom. We think that you go to courtrooms to find some kind of justice, but that justice oftentimes, from what we're seeing, consists of a perpetuation of prevailing prejudices and stereotypes and biases by the jurors, or in this case, this was a judge sitting as fact finder. Even the judges and jurors sitting as fact finders just pass through, perpetuate whatever the prevailing social biases are, and we keep getting these same kinds of acquittals and scratching our heads.
And of course, there was anticipated protest. The governor of Missouri brought in the National Guard on the day that the result of the trial was to be announced, anticipating A, that there would be an acquittal, and B, that people would get upset about it and take to the streets. And he brought in the National Guard. What do you make of this?
Well, this is, again, this gets us to the difference between so-called black-on-black violence and blue-on-black violence, because a lot of people want to change this conversation right away and say, well, again, why are you mourning and grieving the loss of this one young black man to a police officer when so many other black men and women are falling at the hands of their brothers and sisters from gun violence and other kinds of violence. And what they are missing when they make that point in this whole discussion is the fact that police officers act in our name, on our behalf, under color of law, with the badge, with the authority, and since they act on our behalf, they make us complicit in what they do. They are our representatives. So when there is unvindicated blood on their hands, it's that unvindicated blood of black victims is on all our hands. It's on our collective hands. I was at a police commission meeting talking to Charlie Beck, Chief Charlie Beck here in LA, and he came and said, how can a community, he's talking about the black community, expect others to respect them when they don't respect themselves? And again, he was pointing to black on black violence as something we really need to focus on rather than this other kind. I pointed out to Charlie Beck at that commission meeting that he had just said that an attack on an officer is an attack on America. Right. This was after Baton Rouge and Dallas, and he was making it real clear that an attack on an officer is an attack on America. And I said, OK, I understand that, Charlie Beck, and I'm willing to go with that 100%. We fly the flag at half mast when police officers fall, but we don't win when police officers kill innocent blacks. And that is one of the kinds of things we have to concern ourselves with, because that's not just a citizen who's aiming his gun at Philando Castile while a life is oozing out of his body. That's America. If that's not an ordinary citizen who's shooting Walter Scott in the back, then Chief Beck, that's America.
These are people who've been charged.
When you're a victim, right. And then not become an ordinary citizen when you're victimized.
These are people who've been charged with keeping us safe. That's why they get to have the guns. And, you know, it's amazing that their lives are seen as more valuable than ours. Let's turn to what Interim Police Chief of St. Louis Police Department said in the aftermath of the acquittal when the protests were happening. Lawrence O'Toole said the police owned tonight. He said that we're in control. This is our city and we're going to protect it. Now, when he says this is our city, the implication is that the residents of St. Louis that have come out to protest the acquittal of Jason Stockley, that the city doesn't belong to them, it belongs to the police. You know, can you comment on the way in which the ownership of the city has been turned over on its head? To her credit, Mayor Lyda Crewson said that she thought that his comments were inappropriate and inflammatory. And also we've heard reports that police chanted, "Whose streets, our streets?" I mean, again, the police are making this claim. They're planting their flag and saying the city belongs to them against the residents of that city.
Yeah, it's unsettling, but the DOJ report on Ferguson, for example, found that that's pretty much what the relationship was. The police department there and the municipal government was using the black community as an ATM machine. They were basically taking money out of the black community through a lot of fines and citations and pouring it into the city coffers to pay the police officers' salaries and to run the municipal function. So they really did view these streets, as their personal ATM. If you will. So that is precisely the kind of attitude that is coming to the surface now. And we're all getting to see it in plain view. We've had 30 years of a kind of love affair with police. You know, you turn on the television and it's Law and Order SUV. You know, we love police shows that really kind of canonize officers. And there's been a one-way kind of discussion going for about 30 years. And now we're in a moment where we're seeing that there's another side to the officer as a wearing a halo and as a pure paladin kind of hero, that there's also the side that we have here in LA with the chief of the LA Sheriff's Department, Baca, second in command to Naka, and 18 other sheriffs, convicted felons. Right. And this is only in the last couple years. So there are not just a few bad apples, but a lot of police departments are rife with corruption. So we're getting that other picture to come out now, Sonali, to compete with that prevailing one that's come through the media for so long.
Yeah. St. Louis's mayor, Lyda Crewson, was the sole major white candidate against four black candidates when she ran for mayor some months ago, and she won. The city is quite almost equally divided between black and white. 49% of the city's population is black, 43% white. And she did say that there are problems in the police department. She said, "We have a legacy of policies that disproportionately impact people along racial and economic lines." She said, "This is institutional racism." Now, that's, of course, really important. The meager progress that we have made on racial justice in the last few years, and when I say meager, I mean mostly lip service and an acknowledgement that there are problems, but not actual solutions or implementation of solutions. But do you credit the Black Lives Matter movement for at least being able to raise this issue to the level of a dialogue?
Oh yeah, we've lifted this conversation up. It spilled over onto college campuses last year as part of the inclusion, diversity, and equity movement. That student activism on campus was part of a seamless web of activism that you could find also in Ferguson. When I was going to ask to come to universities and speak on inclusion, diversity, and equity matters, I was often being invited by members of their local university Black Lives Matter group. And so the idea of disruption, shut it down. Let's cut through our collective complacency about these festering social justice issues, shut it down. And then number two, let's have some uncomfortable conversations. Those two pillars of the Black Lives Matter methodology have moved the needle over the last couple years, at least in getting us to have these conversations and to take these issues more seriously. Now we got to keep on going.
In fact, the protests have been very strong and actually somewhat multiracial, which is also, of course, heartening. And I'm wondering if you think that those activists who cut their teeth in Ferguson 3 years ago have had an influence in neighboring St. Louis to bring up this issue, because the protests have been very spirited, despite the police showing up in riot gear in the National Guard and, you know, 123 people arrested in one night. There are activists that are still bravely there facing off with police, shutting down streets and saying we can't let business continue as usual.
Yeah, after the Rodney King verdict, the polls were done and there was a temporary increase in the general American consciousness of, among general Americans, a greater awareness of racial justice issues. But that only lasted about 9 months, Sonali, and then it went back to the baseline of not putting racial justice issues or race relations very high in their priority of social issues. This has been a sustained 2 to 3 year movement. It hasn't been just a moment. Rodney King was more of a moment. This is what a movement looks like when it's sustained over time and keeps coming back with added force and different mutations and with different nuances. And so certainly that's what we're seeing. And you're right, the allies of the Black Lives Matter movement have been key. The Latino and white and Asian allies that I've seen marching in the streets and forming chains around downtown LAPD headquarters have been crucial. And they've all recognized that once Black Lives Matter, all lives are going to matter. The Black lives, if you go down to Skid Row here in LA, 75% of Skid Row is Black. Only about four, right? When you go to the prisons, they're grossly disproportionately people by Blacks. You know, the most miserable places in this country are grossly disproportionately peopled by people with Black bodies. And so what, recognizing that the faces at the bottom of the well really are Black, despite these polls in which most white Americans think that there isn't any more anti-Black racism, that comes in poll after poll. So we're living in different social realities. But once we lift those faces at the bottom of the well, that's going to lift all the fortunes for all the marginalized groups in this country. I think that's what's recognized.
And the era that we are in today, going from the first Black president to the first white supremacist president in recent memory, maybe we can put it that way, has, of course, a lot to do with it. Let's talk about the national context of what's happening. I can't help but wonder if interim police chief in St. Louis, Lawrence O'Toole's comments about being in control, about owning the night, are the result of an emboldening of brutal police culture by the Trump administration. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a very important point. Of course, Trump has been embraced by the Fraternal Order of Police and various police unions and various police organizations. And so he's made it clear that he thinks, for example, putting suspects into the back of cars, suspects, mind you, not convicts, suspects in the back of the car and watching out for their head might be handling them with too much in the way of kid's glove. You remember that comment and how people, many officers laughed at this remark about police brutality and his licensing of it. Sadly, there has been some encouragement that can be taken from those kind of comments. But, you know, I think on the whole, Sonali, it's been a good thing that, you know, we used to do politics by dog whistles. You know, rather than talking about black people directly, we talk about welfare queens, you know, with Reagan driving up in Cadillacs, you know, to pick up
their check. So that coded language, yeah.
Right, a lot of coded language. And this said, we're just going to, Donald Trump said, I'm going to be more barefaced than my opponents. I'm going to give it to you uncut and straight. And we can really see what kind of nation we have. And we have, as we've always had, a divided nation. And we have a lot of, you know, people who are striving for more inclusion, diversity, and equity writ large at a national level. And there are others who, when they hear inclusion, diversity, and equity, they hear white genocide. They hear discrimination against Europeans. And so we have to recognize that's just the country we live in, and we have to do the hard political work to try to make this more of the kind of country we want it to be.
So at this point, given what's happened in St. Louis and what's continuing to happen around the country, do you feel that the small amount of scrutiny that is from the federal government that has been taken away because Jeff Sessions has basically said he's going to back off from the in DOJ investigations and the federal consent decrees, that this is very likely going to lead to an increase in police shootings, police brutality, particularly impacting African Americans? You know, we know our federal government doesn't keep track of the numbers of people killed by police, but a lot of journalist outfits are keeping track and police violence. You know, people in other countries are shocked by how many citizens and ordinary Americans our police kill. I feel like we could easily predict that things are going to get worse. Police are going to have more impunity killing us.
Yeah, Sessions is making it clear that there's going to be very little in the way of federal oversight over local police departments and claims about patterns and practices of discrimination against socially marginalized groups like blacks and Latinos and other socially marginalized groups. But I think what may send even a stronger signal to police, or at least as strong a signal of encouragement to keep on doing what they've been doing, is acquittal after acquittal like this, Sonali. You know, when the facts are you have a recording and of the officer saying, I'm going to kill this MF, only he doesn't use the euphemism MF, and his DNA on the gun.
That's what Jason Stockley was heard to have said. What Jason Stockley, yeah.
Yeah, that's what the officer said in the car before the shooting, thank you. The prosecution saying there's pretty strong evidence the gun was planted, the officer's DNA, but not the victim's DNA on it, et cetera. Officers have to look at these kind of cases and say, there's virtually nothing I can't do and get away with it. You know, Rodney King, they have the videotape, and the Simi Valley jury initially acquitted him. We got a deadlocked jury with six jurors saying the Walter Scott getting shot five times in the back wasn't necessarily a police officer stepping outside the bounds. So that's what really sends the strongest a signal of encouragement, Sonali. And then Sessions, of course, adds to the strength of that signal.
So at this point, when we have this current culture in our country where white supremacists are emboldened, who like to say either all lives matter or even worse, blue lives matter, the police seem to become this proxy for the kinds of white nationalist movements that we see coming up. We saw in Charlottesville, for example, a lot of reports that the police just just stood back and let some of the white supremacist and Nazi activists assault residents. And this also is an important angle to consider, right? That we have previously fringe groups coming out into the open who are openly talking about racial superiority and who see the police as their ally.
Oh, no doubt. And we've taken a few steps back because of that. My hope, though, Sonali, is this, that when Donald Trump initially made that remark about not being too careful with suspects when you're putting them into the back of police cruisers and the officers behind him laughed, a number of police departments came out with rejections of that position and said, we do not embrace that approach. We do not identify with the president's comments. They see, those police departments see, that we can make some progress if we can increase the trust and confidence of the community in the police department. They need the community to really do their job of reducing crime. And some departments have started to make some progress. So it's going to be interesting to see some of the tension between what may be going on at the federal level and some of the payoff from the activism at the local level that has brought about some critical reflection by some departments on whether they can do their job in a way that is more constitutional and creates more trust and confidence between the citizens they're policing and the department. So I'm hopeful in that way because I have to try to find something to be hopeful for these days, Sonali, because these kinds of verdicts can be so depressing, they can demoralize you. But I think we got to keep fighting and we got to look for the positive where we can find it.
Jody, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, Sonali. My pleasure.
My guest is Jody Armour. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Law at the University of Southern California, the author of Negrophobia and Reasonable Racism, The Hidden Costs of Being Black in America. And he's our race and criminal justice correspondent. We've been discussing the recent protests in St. Louis, Missouri, over the acquittal in Anthony Lamar Smith's police killing. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.